Hello and welcome to the Android Central Podcast. My name is Daniel Bader. This week on the show, there are a lot of phones coming out soon. So we are going to run down which ones are worth thinking about, which ones are worth buying, and which ones are not coming to the US, because many of them, many of the better value phones are just not hitting North America these days. So we'll discuss why that is. We'll also talk about a new, I don't even know what it is, a licensing program from Qualcomm. It's called Snapdragon Sound. It's a big deal in some ways, not so much in other ways. We'll figure out why. The March feature drop just hit for Pixel phones. It was a little bit disappointing, in my opinion. And we'll also talk about a bunch of new Google hardware launching in the next few months. And then there's this proposed bill out of Arizona that may make it easier to bypass Google when you are buying things in the Play Store. It'll have huge implications if it passes, but it probably won't pass. So join me this week, Jerry Hildenbrand. How are you doing?
Hey, pretty good. How are you?
Yeah, I'm good. It's Friday. We'll talk about why it's Friday as well in a sec. Ara Wagner, how are you? Welcome back.
I am good. The WandaVision finale was amazing.
Shush, quiet. I want to know nothing, not even if it was good, but I'm glad to hear it was good. And Harish Janalagada, welcome back. We are so happy to have you.
Hello. Yeah, it's good to be back. I don't think I did this for a few months.
What time is it?
8:45.
So I am a bad person. Because I am Harish's boss, and I'm making him podcast at 8:45 p.m. on Friday night.
On a Friday, yeah.
So I'm very grateful that you are willing to do this before you go off and enjoy your night.
You need to send him some flowers or something.
I'm just one of those nerds that's amazed that we can still do a real-time podcast when I'm here in Toronto, the two of you are down in the U.S., and you are in India, Harish, and it just, yeah. It's flawless and it's amazing. I love that we could do this. So let's get started. You broke some news this week, Harish, all about the upcoming OnePlus Nord 2. So you talked about this last year a little bit, and at the time we weren't entirely sure what it was, if it was a Nord SE or whether it was a brand new phone. We now know that this is a brand new phone. It's coming soon-ish. And the big deal about it is that it will have a MediaTek SoC, not a Qualcomm SoC. This is, I think, MediaTek's biggest get for a mainstream phone launch in quite a while. So talk us through what this means. First, what is the Nord 2, given that now that Pete Lau is sort of alone at the top of OnePlus, does the Nord mean anything without Carl Pei in the driver's seat? How is it going to stay different from like the OnePlus 9R? And why did MediaTek get this big get as opposed to Qualcomm's mid-range 5G chips?
Yeah, as for whether the Nord series will continue in this direction without Carl Pei, I think it will. Because from what I've seen of their 2020 sales, it was just the Nord series that got them a bulk of their sales. The 8 and 8 Pro and even the 8T to a certain extent did not do as well in terms of sales figures as they were hoping for. So the Nord actually ended up doing really well in markets like India. It continues to, I think it released here over 6 months ago, and it continues to be the best-selling phone in that premium, mid-premium segment. And that was actually a bulk of their sales in India. And they actually released the Nord N10 and N100 in the US, I think 3 months ago, and they've done better than they were hoping for in that market as well. So they've been excited by this progress. So they're going to, I think, double down on that. I have a few details on what else they're working on for 2021. But the first phone that's coming out is the Nord 2. This is a direct successor to the original Nord that debuted last July. And this is going to show up primarily in India, the UK, and a few other markets around the world. And it is a big deal that they're going with MediaTek instead of Qualcomm, because until now, OnePlus has exclusively used Snapdragon chipsets, and not even just any Snapdragon, just Qualcomm's flagship 800 series. So it is interesting that they would choose to strike out with MediaTek for this one.
Yeah, so the Dimensity series is pretty, I wouldn't say it's well known in the West yet, right? This is a series that the Dimensity 1000 launched last CES. It was sort of a big deal because it encompassed a lot of what we thought of as flagship features and a relatively inexpensive SoC. MediaTek as a company is kind of known for more budget-focused projects, right? If a company does not want to shell out the money for a Qualcomm flagship or even a Qualcomm mid-range phone, SoC, they'll go with a MediaTek solution. How does something like the 1200, the Dimensity 1200, compare to a Snapdragon S765G or something in the mid to high budget range? I don't even know what we call it. Mid-range nice is what MKBHD called it in a previous video, and I think I like that one. So what is the Dimensity 1200?
So the Dimensity 1200 is their current flagship. It's built on a 6-nanometer node. It's on par with the Snapdragon 888 in that regard, because the 888 is on a 5-nanometer. And it has the Cortex-A78 cores. It has one running at 3 gigahertz. That's really nice to see, because that means that it can launch things like games faster than what it was able to in the past. And it has 3 cores at 2.6 gigahertz, and it has the same energy efficient A55 cores. Now, compare this to what the Nord was running, the Snapdragon 765G. That was on the Cortex-A76 cores. So I think OnePlus, one of the reasons for going with MediaTek was that they saw that this chipset offered better performance in terms of what its price positioning was compared to what Qualcomm was offering in that mid-tier segment. And they decided to take a chance with it, because from a hardware point of view, this actually offers a lot in terms of just the cores and the GPU, because it's running a Mali G77 GPU with 9 cores. So it should deliver slightly better performance when it comes to gaming as well. And if OnePlus was able to secure a deal where they got this for about the same price that they would have paid for a mid-tier Qualcomm chipset, it would have been a big win for them.
All right, so we know that this will it's unlikely that it'll hit North America, but is something like the Dimensity 1000 series able to go toe-to-toe with the Snapdragon 888 in North America in terms of 5G connectivity? Like, is this a chip that can be subbed in on a Galaxy S21 and people wouldn't really notice a difference? Or are there functional differences between the two that people here in North America would notice?
Oh yeah, absolutely. So there should not be any difference in terms of 5G, because MediaTek has actually, that is one of the key standout features of the new Dimensity chipsets. MediaTek went really hard on global 5G connectivity with both sub-6 and millimeter wave, and it also does 5G dual SIM. That particular feature is something that Qualcomm hasn't adopted yet. It's still relying on that 5G primary SIM, and the secondary SIM falls back to 4G. So it doesn't offer a 5G dual SIM solution yet, but MediaTek does on the Dimensity 1200 and even some of the lower tier Dimensity stuff. I've used the Redmi Note 90 with the Dimensity 800U, and that had that same global 5G along with 5G dual SIM, dual standby. And that's a big deal outside the US, because I believe US is the only market that still relies primarily on single SIM solutions because of the carrier situation. But everywhere else, dual SIM phones are standard, and a lot of people actually use both the SIM card slots. So having that particular feature gives MediaTek a slight edge over Qualcomm. And as for performance, I've used a lot of phones with the Dimensity 1000 Plus, the 800U, and it's about the same. I couldn't notice any difference versus similarly priced Qualcomm designs. So yeah, MediaTek seems to be doing all the right things in that mid-tier to mid-tier nice segment.
Right. So we do have one phone in the US that uses MediaTek's Dimensity chip. And randomly, we sort of were amazed when we heard it in September last year. It was the T-Mobile variant of the LG Velvet. that launched with the Dimensity 1000C. And we haven't really heard anything about it since, right? It got reviewed. People were kind of nonplussed. It was a good mid-range phone, and that was it. We haven't really heard anything. But is this MediaTek sort of AMD moment? Is it going to come out of the shadows and into the light and take over the mid-range slash mid-range nice SoC space? Or is this just sort of adding a little bit more pressure to Qualcomm's already dominant and still dominant status?
I think we will see more brands using it because that has already been the case. In the last 2 to 3 years, MediaTek got a lot of design wins in the budget segment with the Helio stuff, and they've done a lot of interesting things there. And they've positioned their products more aggressively against what Qualcomm was offering. So they were able to lure away these big, big name sellers like the Redmi Note 8 series and stuff like that. So that has worked really well for them. And they're emulating that similar sort of strategy in the mid-range segment now with the Dimensity chipsets. The Nord 2 would be their most high-profile phone yet with a MediaTek chipset. And this is a device that's expected to sell a few million units over the course of the year. So this gets them that visibility in that segment that a lot of people are looking for. And I think this is the start of, this is definitely their AMD moment. Because their products are positioned well, they're offering a similar level of performance as Qualcomm, and more than anything else, I think they've sorted out their driver update situation. Because I believe what set them back in the past was that their drivers were not able to be optimized, and it took them MediaTek phones took a lot longer to receive updates, and that turned off their products for a lot of OEMs. But they fixed that issues with the Dimensity stuff. And that's why we're starting to see more of these designs in mid-range phones.
Let's close out the Nord 2 conversation. When can we expect it? How much will it cost?
That's interesting. So from what I understand right now, it should be somewhere around the June, July timeframe, similar to what the Nord released at last year. As for pricing, it's going to vary wildly between markets. In India, the original Nord still costs around $335, and that's insane. That's like $150 less than what the same variant costs in the UK. So it should be around the same, because anything over that $400 price point would make the phone a non-starter in India, just because of how competitive that segment is right now. So it should be under $400 in India and around the $450 to $500 price point in the UK.
All right, let's do some Indian phone market lightning round because there are just so many phones that are launching right now. The Redmi Note 10 series, we have the Redmi Note 10, 10 Pro, and 10 Max. What is the big deal about this Xiaomi-launched product line? The Redmi series sells like hotcakes, we know that. But why, if you've never heard of it, is it a big deal for people?
Okay, so Xiaomi is doing really well with the Redmi Note series. Just the Redmi Note phones average around 7 or 8 million sales a month globally. With the Redmi Note 10 series, they've switched to AMOLED panels, and the Note 10 Pro Max and the Note 10 Pro have 120Hz refresh rate as standard. They have much better cameras. That's been the driver for Xiaomi in the last 2 years for the Redmi Note line. They've consistently come out with better cameras in that segment. And they also have interesting designs this time. Xiaomi has never had a unified design language because its flagships always stood out. They were very different in terms of how they looked to their budget Redmi stuff. But this time they're going for that unified look so that the Redmi Note 10 looks very similar to the Mi 11. And that's a good thing.
Right. And you just reviewed the Mi 11. You liked it a lot. You said it was a really good competitor to the Galaxy S21. The interesting thing about the Redmi Note 10 Pro Max, which is a terrible name, primary camera sensor is the Samsung HM2, which is the same one that's found in the Galaxy Note 20 Ultra. It has since been succeeded by the one that's in the S21 Ultra, but this is still a really high quality sensor in a phone that costs like 300 US equivalent, which is kind of bananas. What's the SoC in it?
This has the Snapdragon 732G.
Okay, so it's a mid-range chip with a really high-end camera, basically.
Yeah.
Okay. Very, very cool. All right, let's move on to the Realme GT5G, which is another mouthful, but I actually think this is a racing stripe phone. Literally, yeah. It has a racing stripe on the back of it. I'll be honest, I don't know much about this phone other than it's made by Realme, which is a sub-brand of Oppo, right?
Well, they're no longer a sub-brand. They're now their own entity, but they're still part of that BBK umbrella.
Right. Okay. So they're OnePlus equivalent, I suppose. They're under the BBK name. Tell us about this, because if this came out of North America, like, people would go crazy. the phone nerds, the people who buy their phones on Amazon unlocked, would go crazy for this.
Yeah, I think this is going to be 2021's Poco F1, because the specs here are just bananas. It has a 6.4-inch Super AMOLED 120Hz panel. It's powered by the Snapdragon 888, and it has the latest RAM modules and UFS 3.0 storage, a 64MP camera, a large 4500 mAh battery, and 65W fast charging, and it retails for around $430 in China.
That's a lot. How much does the Mi 11, for instance, cost in China?
The Mi 11 is around $650 in China, but in the UK and other European markets, it's debuting at 749 euros. So that's closer to around $850 or $900.
Right. So will this leave China? Like, will you find the GT in India or in parts of Europe where Realme does have a presence as well?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. They're already figuring out a launch for the Indian market, and it should make its way to the UK later in the year as well.
Yeah, I really hope to see more phones like this, because it's just a lot. It's a lot of phone. The racing stripe kills me. All right, let's talk about the Samsung phones that are expected to launch in the next couple of weeks. So we have the A32, which is already available in India. It's a pretty run-of-the-mill mid-range or budget-ish phone to take on the Mi 10i. It looks fine. I don't know. It's kind of weird. It has these, like, this triple camera set up on the back, but there's no module. There's no, like, outline at all. So it's just these spider eyes that are just staring at you.
It's like a honeycomb.
No. Sure. Okay. Let's go with the honeycomb.
Forgive me for giving it the benefit of the doubt. I like the blue and the purple.
The blue is, yeah, the colors are definitely nice. So what's going on with this? Because obviously the A series had its best year in 2020. The A51 was the second best selling phone in the world after the iPhone 11. So we know that Samsung did really well with it. They are committing to better software updates for the A series this year. Tell us about the A32 and whether people should really care about it.
Okay, so the A32, the best thing about it is that it has better hardware than the A31, because as many units as Samsung sold last year, the phone itself was not good at all. So in that regard, the A32 actually gets a lot of things right. It still has an AMOLED panel, but it now has 90Hz refresh rate. And this one is also using MediaTek's Helio G80 processor. So MediaTek is actually getting a lot of wins in that budget segment. And it has a 64-megapixel camera at the back and a massive 5,000 mAh battery. Fast charging is just 50 watts, but that's still decent enough. This thing does not have the same kind of specs as what you would find on a Redmi or Realme phone in this category. But Samsung is still going to sell like a boatload of these just because of the fact that they're available everywhere. And this should make its way to other markets pretty soon.
All right. So phones we might actually want to care about are the A52 5G and A72 5G. So we don't know a ton about these yet. There have been pretty extensive leaks on the A52. It is rumored to have a Snapdragon 750G. In North America, it's rumored to get monthly security updates, at least for the first few years, which would put it on par with the phone, with the company's high-end phones. This comes after Samsung promised 4 years of security patches for phones, including its new A-series devices, which is fantastic. The A51, in spite of its very, very poor performance, was a huge seller. The A51 5G was better because it ran a Snapdragon chip. What do we know so far about the A52 5G, A72 and A72 5G? And we have to make that distinction because they will be very different phones, right? The 4G versions won't come to, they'll kind of stay in the South Asia area. They will only be 4G capable. They'll have a much less powerful processor, etc. So what do we know about them so far?
Yeah, so the A52 should have a 120 hertz AMOLED, so that should make it on par with the S20 FE and phones like that. I believe Samsung is using the exact same panel that it used in the S20 FE, so that's good to see. And it has a 64 megapixel camera at the back, a 32 megapixel camera at the front, and 4500 milliamp hour battery with 25 watt fast charging. Now, the thing that sold, that made Samsung sell so many of these last year was the fact that it was available everywhere at a time when most brands had issues with having units for sale, because we saw that with OnePlus, and Samsung did not have those issues. And that's one of the reasons why the A51 and A71 sold a little better than what even Samsung was expecting. But the A52 continues that momentum. It has decent hardware upgrades across the board, and the software update situation makes it head and shoulders above any other mid-range phone in this category, because as good as Xiaomi and Realme do when it comes to hardware, they still are lagging behind when it comes to consistent software updates.
Right. Yeah. And Samsung is so far ahead there. They're actually, I think, for the first time, Samsung is understanding the benefit of its scale, right? It's not only on the hardware side, but the software side, that you can release a single software SKU and then roll out very similar variants across all of its devices without really making many changes. And that has been enormously beneficial to people who don't want to spend $1,000 on the latest Galaxy S21 Ultra or something like that. All right, let's move on to what I think is a pretty interesting product. This is the Huawei Mate X2. Ara, I'm sure you've seen this. This is a Galaxy Z Fold 2 from Huawei, essentially. It's an INI rather than an Audi, but it has a massive front display and it folds flatter. It's wider than the Galaxy Z Fold 2. I'm never going to get that name right. What's your first impression, just from a hardware perspective, compared to the Z Fold 2?
I mean, my first thought whenever I see this is, God, this would be great if we could actually see it in the West, but we won't.
Yes, that is true.
I mean, it's got a nice big display. I'm happy that it's a little bit wider, because hopefully that'll make it easier to split screen two apps and then still have the keyboard down at the bottom. But yeah, it's hard for me to get excited about this, because it's one of those things of, this would be so fun to play with, but it's not going to be something I'm ever going to get my hands on.
Harish, like, we know the story here with Huawei. They are locked out of Google services. They have their own app gallery. This phone is interesting because it really does, it's a marked shift in engineering from the first two Mate X phones, right? The Mate X and Mate XS. Obviously, without Google services, you don't really get access to the benefits of the Play Store, but the App Gallery is doing better than it was. But the hardware here is pretty impressive. I mean, it's got a 90 hertz panel inside. It's almost a 1-to-1 ratio screen inside. It's 8 by 7.1, so it's a pretty big tablet like display. It seems like it's just really beautiful hardware. There's a good camera inside. But what's interesting to me is that Huawei is saying that this is going to be the first phone to be upgraded to Harmony OS. So right now, it's running Android without Play services, but in a few months, it's going to get an update to Harmony OS. We saw with when Ars Technica looked into it, right now Harmony OS is basically Android, but Huawei says that that will not be the case when it launches fully. What do we know about the final version of Harmony OS? What is it actually going to be? Because it's obviously still going to be Android, AOSP Android, somewhere below the surface, as much as Huawei wants to obfuscate that fact. But how do we know what, like, how it will play into the company's longer term strategy?
I think it's just Android 10 with all Google mentions removed, because I read that Ars Technica post, and I highly doubt that they would be able to totally overhaul that entire interface in just 6 months, because that's when Harmony OS is meant to release. So I don't think this is going to be anything different to Android. But I think they're doing it as a way to make everyone... I don't understand the fact that it is they were able to build something on their own. I don't believe that to be the case, but it is... If this is what it takes for them to sell phones globally again, I think I could see it working. But then again, the problem is with the App Store, because even as good as it is right now, and they've been pushing hard for developers to get their apps on their own app stores, that hasn't really worked out in the last 2 years.
Right. Yeah, it hasn't worked out, but they've been improving their sort of in-app discovery. So Pedal Search weirdly still sends you to a bunch of sketchy APK download sites, but the app itself is getting better about finding decent versions of the APKs. The problem is updates. So there's really still, if you download an app from the app gallery, it'll be updated. But if you download an app from the Pedal Search, whatever, it's very difficult to update it, especially passively, right? With the Play Store, with the App Gallery, you just say update all and it does the work for you. If you manually download these apps, you need to manually update them, or at least approve every single update, which can take a long time. I've had to do this on the P40 Pro. And the other part still that will never get resolved is if an app that you download requires Play services in any form, usually mapping or notifications, if it uses Firebase for notifications, it will just not work. Like Slack, I cannot use a Huawei phone in my life anymore because Slack does not support push notifications, period. And if I can't get Slack on a phone with notifications, I can't do my job. And that basically disqualifies every single Huawei phone on the planet right now. And that doesn't seem to be changing anytime soon. I don't see Slack making an effort to upload their app, its app to the app gallery. So we're stuck in that place.
Yeah. And that's the biggest problem, because Huawei is doing a lot of interesting things with design. I mean, the Mate X2 looks fantastic. Also doing a great job with cameras and with hardware itself, with its Kirin unit. But the fact that they don't have that software situation sorted out just makes them a non-starter outside of China.
Yeah. All right. Well, we can wait and see what's next. All right. Let's talk a little bit about the Qualcomm Snapdragon Sound announcement. So this was interesting. I got to talk to one of the leads of the program. It's not nearly as exciting as I hoped it would be, but it's also quite ambitious if it works. So those two things don't sound like they align, but they actually do. So Harish, why don't you give us a quick rundown of what Snapdragon Sound is, and then we'll bring Jerry in to talk a little bit about why it's necessary from a technical perspective.
Okay. So Snapdragon Sound is essentially a certification program, so that if a phone manufacturer is making a phone, they can leverage this branding when they're building a phone. So on a phone side, that means if somebody is using the Snapdragon 888, it would have that Snapdragon Sound branding. And for audio makers who are building wireless earbuds or any other audio product, they can also leverage Qualcomm's Bluetooth audio SoCs and other audio and video technologies and integrate that and make sure that everything is interoperable. I think that is the key goal here, because Qualcomm didn't necessarily announce any new tech, but it's bringing all of its different audio divisions together under one label so that it's easier for not just phone makers, but also audio manufacturers building wireless audio gear. And the end goal here is to provide better fidelity, lower latency, and just ensure that wireless audio is, while not on the same level as wired audio, at least close to that.
Right. So we know that there are kind of three elements to this. There's the mobile platforms. So the Snapdragon 888, for example, that needs to, the company that puts the SoC in the phone needs to be a part of the Snapdragon Sound program. Right now, that's just Xiaomi, which is what it is, which is odd. Xiaomi does not have a presence in North America at all, basically. So Snapdragon Sound will essentially not exist in North America until another phone maker comes on board. We then have the headset and earbud technology. That's the little SoC, the little processor that goes into the earbud that is that kind of is the digital side of the analog product, right? So we're talking about a company like Jabra, or in this case, Audio Technica, which is the first launch partner as part of the Snapdragon Sound program. They put this little SoC in, and it does all the work to connect the drivers to the amplifier and the Bluetooth radio to send the signal down to the phone, etc. Then there's the third part, which is the software and the codecs. So this is where it gets interesting, right? Because Qualcomm is saying that by bringing all of these divisions together, they get lower latency from the headphone to the phone and back. They also get higher quality with their aptX adaptive codec. But the only beneficiary at the moment is Amazon Music HD. So we have three players at launch. We have Xiaomi, Audio Technica, and Amazon. Xiaomi products are not available really. I mean, they're available in Europe. So I guess the crossover there is if you have a Xiaomi phone that's certified with a Snapdragon 888 and a pair of Audio Technica earbuds that are certified, and you're using Amazon Music HD at high bitrate playback, you'll be able to benefit from this. Jerry, talk me through why a company like Qualcomm, which is not really consumer facing, would start a certification program that would then require companies to slap their logo on the box so that people might get to know Qualcomm as a company a little bit better.
You know, the branding is, it is what it is. You can't blame Qualcomm for wanting to get their brand out there and take a little bit of credit. I agree. It's kind of odd that this is the, you know, the product they want to make Qualcomm a consumer name out of. But when I first heard about this, I thought back, remember the HTC 10?
That, I still have one. Yeah, I like sitting that in phone. A drawer.
The audio on it was incredible. And they were a little coy because I talked to them about it, you know, how they're doing it. It turns out that it was just using the Snapdragon chip, and HTC hired audio engineers, and they built a what Qualcomm is using now for, you know, they call it AQSTIC. I have no idea how to pronounce that.
Acoustic. But,
acoustic. Okay. Jeez. Oh, that's
the most startup
bad
name for like an internal product ever.
But they did that, and then they had custom built amplifiers, and that made that phone sound incredible. Like it sounded like one of the LG phones that had a big name, you know, audio package inside it with a dedicated audio chipset and amplifier. And that's what Qualcomm is offering here. They're, look, you can buy all of this from us, and as long as you buy headphones that use our equipment too, you're going to get better quality audio than you would with anything else. And right now it's just Amazon. I'm not completely bought on that. I don't know why, if you were playing local HD quality audio or a video with high quality audio track, why it wouldn't just work. That sounds like something that they would have to purposefully make not work if it's just using the standard audio path. But this is a big deal, especially to a company like Xiaomi. Xiaomi makes incredible phones, and maybe they don't want to go out and spend an extra $50 to $100 per phone to have a high-end audio package built for it. Well, now they can just work it in with their licensing for the Snapdragon chip, and I'll bet it's fairly cheap when you look at it from that perspective. And that's another win. That's a big tick in the Xiaomi column for, you know, high quality audio, with a little asterisk, and down at the bottom, the fine print says when paired with specific headphones. For the headphone makers, it's an even bigger deal. We all have used really good Bluetooth headphones and really bad Bluetooth headphones. And the sound difference, even something like a voice call, it's miles apart. Now this allows companies that probably don't have the budget to build out, you know, a better sounding audio path inside a tiny Bluetooth earbud, which is really difficult, I'm sure. Qualcomm can do it for them. Just buy our chip and use it, and this all just works when it's paired with any phone that has this branding on the box. So it's a win for manufacturers. If it becomes popular, it's a win for consumers. I'm not sure how popular it's going to become. A mid-range set of earbuds, let's be honest, sound good enough for most people.
Right. So the thing that Qualcomm explained to me here is that they're starting high because they are using the best, they're using the cleanest route to get to high performance, right? So if they have the fastest chip with the best DSP that supports the highest the newest Bluetooth standard and the highest quality codecs all the way through the pipeline, right? With the best quality amplifiers, with the earbuds that have the most expensive Bluetooth SoC so that they can lower latency, et cetera, then that's how they're going to pilot this project. They're only starting with three companies because they really wanted it to work. And eventually, like all Qualcomm features, it dips down into the mid-range and then the budget section. And I think this is where they're aiming. They want Snapdragon sound for mid-range products released by the $50 true wireless earbud maker on Amazon that you don't really know or trust. But they're taking for granted that if you see a Snapdragon Sound logo somewhere on Amazon, you get a minimum value, a minimum sound quality that is, you can take for granted will be good enough for the price segment.
Right, because I've bought, you know, especially when they first came out, wireless earbuds that I won't even use. And, you know, it's not because I'm an audio snob. It's just because they sound horrible.
Oh, yeah. The first gen audio, the TW stuff was real bad.
So now Qualcomm can take that completely out of the equation. Just, I guess that explains their branding. Well, see, you did it for me. You see that little badge, you know it's going to sound at least good.
Yeah, and we're hoping for, I'm hoping that it will have just a wide movement for the true wireless earbud industry, because we're not really talking about the Samsungs and Jabras of the world that really need help here. We're talking about the companies that don't have the R&D budgets to invest in building their own Bluetooth stack, or their, you know, that can't really tune their products by themselves, and that's where they turn to Qualcomm for like a turnkey solution.
Or it also helped companies like, Tautronics is a good example. They already make wireless earbuds that sound really good, especially for the price. But if you knock $15 off the price, potentially, I'm just throwing a number out there, they're now competing with earbuds that don't sound good at all.
Right. Yeah, exactly.
So, yeah. And the biggest deal, I think, out of all this, I mean, I love how Qualcomm put their name on, aptX Adaptive. It's not Qualcomm aptX Adaptive. That's in your MacBook. It's not called Apple aptX Adaptive in your MacBook. But the amplifier, if Qualcomm is putting a high-quality amplifier directly on the SoC, even the especially the small one for earbuds, that's a huge R&D savings for any company that makes, wireless headphones of any sort, because that's expensive and difficult.
Yeah, and Qualcomm's hoping that the investment in the licensing for Snapdragon Sound will eventually be offset by the fact that they can take a lot of the R&D off their hands and the integration.
Right.
And just worry about the audio side of it, right? Finding the right drivers, making the best design, optimizing the battery, et cetera, and that Qualcomm do the digital stuff for them.
Yep. This is especially if you like to listen to music, this is a pretty big deal. It doesn't seem like it, because as you mentioned, it's no new technology, but what it can become maybe 2 years down the road is a huge deal when you can save a lot of money and still have stuff that sounds great.
Definitely. All right. Let's bring you into this. I want to talk about the Pixel feature drop that just hit at the beginning of March. There's a rumored Google event happening pretty soon, and there's just a lot of Google stuff going on. Talk us through first the Pixel feature update, what it brought, what it didn't bring, and why it was a kind of a muted month, in fact, for Pixel owners.
They can't all be blockbuster releases, guys. I mean, there's going to be some that are fun. There's going to be some that are just, okay, this is useful, but maybe not for me, which that was kind of what a lot of this month's Pixel drop was, because we had... we got a web interface for Google Recorder, which is awesome if you're somebody who actually, takes a lot of interviews or uses a Google Recorder to record your lectures for school. So you'll be able to share those with anybody, even if they don't have a Pixel, and they're going to be able to play those back in the web interface for Google Recorder. So that's useful. It's a niche thing, but it's useful. Another thing that's very, very niche, but is exciting, I guess, if you're going to plan a deep sea vacation after all of COVID is over, is that Google added support for underwater photography through, what was the actual name for it? The dive, a camera, they added Dive Connector, which will allow you to use it with Kraken Sports Universal Smartphone housing in order to use Pixel's camera prowess underwater, which sounds awesome. At the same time, it's not that awesome for most of us, because most of us can't really go on vacation right now until we get the vaccine.
Can we just talk about this for a second? Because I want to talk about the most... This is the googliest thing ever. They are adding support for a single universal phone house made by one company called Kraken Sports. It costs $325. And if you put your Pixel phone in this housing and then open the camera app, only then will it give you this underwater mode. I'm like, it's such a Google thing to do that they're like, here, put a, like, imagine buying a $350 Pixel 4a and then saying, oh, I'm going to buy a $325 camera housing so that I can use my phone underwater. I'm sure that five people are going to benefit from this, but it is remarkable that this actually got included in this month's feature drop.
I agree, but if you look at it from the opposite side, if you've ever used any type of, acrylic based enclosure. When I was a kid, I grew up down in Florida, and my dad had one for an old 35 millimeter film camera that we used to take out when we were snorkeling. The images all look like crap because light doesn't refractor through, you know, acrylic the way we want it to. And your camera is really, really bad, even an expensive camera. So this wasn't that simple of a thing to do, which makes you wonder why Google took the time to make it happen, you know, like you said, for one product.
Google's going to Google, man. All right. So we got some dolphin photos out of this month. What else did we get?
We only got three wallpapers this month, which is kind of disappointing to me because I was really hoping that the curated culture collection was going to get filled out a little bit more quickly. But we got last year we got three wallpapers for Black History Month. This year we got three wallpapers for International Women's Day, which is Monday. And last month's wallpapers were done by a female African-American creator who I believe is based in Tampa, not that far from here. And this month's wallpapers were done by a Spanish illustrative duo. So they're interesting wallpapers. I like the pink one the best, but that's just me. But I do wish we could have gotten a few more and could have gotten them from multiple female creators, because God knows there are so many great female artists out there who already make great wallpapers.
Yeah. I like these. I mean, they're very stylized.
They're distinctive.
Yeah. But it's cool to have them.
Yes, it is. But yeah, that was about it for this month. So we have, apart from that, we had the new stuff with the dock, which I don't use a Pixel stand, so I completely spaced it that we got that. We had a couple of improvements to routines and a couple of updates to messaging.
And Smart Compose for people in certain messaging apps, that's being integrated. I don't use Smart Compose. I turn it off when I can. But I guess it's useful. Like do you guys use Smart Compose for your for Gmail and stuff?
I use it on Gmail.
Depends on who I'm replying to. I might be a little bit out of sorts from time to time and just laugh and click whatever Google wants me to say. Just to see what it comes up with.
Yeah, but Jerry, it's trained on your data. So it's going to be accurate.
That's
for
what makes
you.
It funnier.
it's when it's like sober Jerry. It knows. It's like, oh, yeah. are you high right now, Jerry? I'm just going to do this for you. let me do this. Google's like, I'll be your designated driver here.
It's good just enough to make the parts where it's not good stand out and be hilarious.
Yeah, that's why I like your emails, because they're always very fun to read. All right, so Google, this is actually interesting, because if we'd recorded this yesterday, then we wouldn't have had this little tidbit. But early today on Friday, John Prosser, who has a pretty decent record with leaks, and especially Apple and Google stuff, he says new Pixel Buds are coming mid-April, and then a new Google phone is scheduled for June 11th this year. He says he doesn't know which one it is yet, but he knows that it's coming. So let's start with the earbuds. The re-release, the true wireless version of the Pixel Buds, were announced in October 2019 and then rolled out in April of 2020. It's been a year. It will have been a year. The Pixel Buds are great hardware, but they are still just felled by connectivity problems. I cannot use them, period.
It's the made by Google curse. I mean, I'm sorry. It just has to exist at this point.
It sucks.
I mean, like, I believe in magic, but this is dark magic here, because every single Google everything released by Google hardware has to have some sort of debilitating software bug that is going to be worked out like months down the line, only for something else to come up. Like, come on, guys.
I am really hoping for a Pixel 2 to the first Pixel version of this, where they just iron out all the kinks and they just make a much better, you know, the Pixel 2, not the Pixel 2 XL, which had its own issues.
Its own issues.
But I'm really hoping that Google doesn't mess with a good thing in terms of design and just fixes the underlying hardware and connectivity problems.
Yeah, I mean, it won't take much for the Pixel Buds 3 or Pixel Buds Lite or whatever these are. Like, I'm of the impression that these probably aren't going to be, like, $200 Pixel Buds 3 so much as they might be a more scaled down but better, but more consistent Pixel Buds Lite.
Interesting. Okay.
So that way they can better compete with, what's on the market. Because, I mean, like, even Samsung was like, okay, we're going to do these $200 wireless earbuds, but before that, we're going to put out some, like, hundreds and 130, so that way they're a little bit more affordable.
Right, because these are $180.
Yeah, and I would love to play with some Pixel Buds because I haven't gotten to touch those at all. I don't see them being another pair of $200 earbuds, especially after what's happened with the Pixel Buds too. I see these being a more like lightweight, skin down, maybe not ANC, although I hope they're ANC. But lighter duty earbuds that they can use as a, okay, we've gotten our software act together, try these instead.
Yeah, that's a good point.
And then if those work, we'll come back to Pixel Buds 3.
I think getting the software act together, it's a mighty big reach. I don't know. I don't know for sure, but I have a feeling that Google uses an open source Bluetooth stack. And it's good, but it's only good if you can spend a lot of power to send the signal back and forth, and with battery operated devices you can't. So that's why, you know, everybody out there that uses Linux on your laptop or your computer, don't come at me. I know it works fine on a PC, but Google phones have always been plagued by Bluetooth issues, and a lot of other Google devices are as well. So it makes me wonder if they use that same open source Bluetooth stack across all their products.
It would explain a few things Bluetooth-wise on the Pixel series.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, it really, like, Google positioned the Pixel Buds as working really well with Pixel phones, and I found it was slightly more stable with a Pixel phone. And the thing that I really struggled with was, is this an endemic problem, right? Google never really addressed the issue broadly. They posted a bunch of times in the product forums when people would complain about it. And I could not reproduce the Bluetooth connectivity issues consistently either. And what I found was that in areas where there was just a lot of 2.4 gigahertz noise, that's when they would fall out of sync. So if I was sitting at my desk and I could control the environment, it wouldn't be a problem. But whenever I took my dog for a walk and I was standing inside the dog park, which is a really wide open space, I just could not get them to stay in sync. And it was pretty consistent. Like, I could go behind a tree and they would come back, and then I would go into the middle of the field and they would fall out of sync again. And it didn't really matter which phone it was. It was, again, slightly better on a Pixel, but not always. I just ended up tossing them in a drawer because I couldn't get them to work properly. And then we were waiting and waiting for this software update that was purportedly supposed to fix the connectivity problems. And there wasn't an update from September through to February. There was a minor update in late February for the Pixel Buds, but it did not address that underlying connectivity issue. And Google has not said a thing about it since. So I don't know. I mean, I'm pretty bummed about the whole thing, because it really did ruin one of the best products from a hardware perspective that Google has released in a very long time.
Maybe Google should switch to the Snapdragon sound bandwagon.
I was thinking it, but wasn't going to say it.
I mean, yeah. I mean, the bigger news here is that we would get a Google phone June 11th, a phone launching June 11th and being announced at I/O is totally within the realm of possibility, and it would also get us closer. It would also bring the A series back closer to its original timeline, which was the A launched at Google I/O and the regular Pixel launches in the fall, which we need because that's the better way to help distinguish the phones from each other.
Okay, so yeah, let's talk a little bit about that. June 11th, it's obviously the Pixel 5a. We've already seen a leak for it. We know that it's going to be a bigger version of the 4a with the newer Qualcomm chip, the 750G. What else? There's really not a ton more to think about here other than this may be a 350 phone that only comes in one size and it's a big size. And for you, that's a problem, I think.
It is, but I also have a Pixel 4a, so I don't have to upgrade. Like, the same thing here is the same thing I said with the, I wrote an editorial about the Galaxy S, about wanting the S21 to have been like an S21e to follow the S10e. Because, I mean, like, if we're going to do, we don't need a small phone every single year from Google, but we need one, like, every 2 or 3 years. So if the Pixel 4a is going to be the small one and the Pixel 5a is going to be the big one, then the Pixel 6a could be the small one again. And I would be perfectly happy with that. Because a phone should last you at least 2 years.
Yeah.
And it should last 24 hours on a charge, with the little ones don't.
Yeah.
That's why people like the big ones.
Yeah. People like the big ones because they can set the text bigger like that. Like for my dad, he needed a big screen because he cranks up the screen zoom and the text size because it's easier on his eyes. So having a big Pixel Pixel A series will make it easier for a larger percentage of the population to want to buy it. And yeah, it also means that you can stick in a bigger battery. And God, I really hope we could just squeeze wireless charging into this one. I don't even care if it's fast wireless charging. Just give me 5-watt wireless charging on this phone and I will be happy.
I don't think it's going to happen, Ara. I really don't.
Why? It's not that hard. We have had wireless charging for like 6 years now.
Yeah, I mean, well, that's true.
We've had wireless charging since 1903, I think, when Tesla invented it.
Yeah. We've had key charging for at least 6 years, and I say this as somebody who has like 20 different wireless chargers in her apartment to test out. And I, whenever I switched to whenever I was on the Pixel 4a, I would be like, oh, I got another wireless charger I need to test. Ah, crap, I gotta break out the S20 because the Pixel 4a couldn't use them.
When you do that, you take a dollar part and add $5 gazillion R&D to fit it in without causing extra heat and interference with radio antennas. And wireless charging isn't easy for a device that has a wireless radio. It's just not. There's a lot of money that goes into making it work while allowing your phone to still be a phone. And Google's just not going to spend the money to do that on a budget Pixel phone, especially they know people were kind of happy with the way it was without wireless charging.
Yeah, I'm happy. But just because something is good doesn't mean it can't be improved. And you just said it was a dollar part. I don't think the R&D to make sure that you can wireless charge on the Pixel 4a would add on that much cost.
Bet you'd be surprised when you...
I probably would be, and I'm sure that all the extra costs this year have just been eaten up by, we got to put 5G in this one.
I mean, you know that's true, though. Like, if they still... I don't think they'll hit the $350 mark. I think it'll be $400. But yeah. If it's $400, I don't think there's going to be wireless charging.
Nope, because then it would need to be $500.
Let me dream, guys.
I agree with you, though. Like, I'll take wireless charging.
It's not a hard dream.
I'll take wireless charging over IP rating, right?
Yeah, like, I love being able to just have... I have this little... I have a wooden key charger that sits on my nightstand. It was sent to me alongside a Galaxy S10 case 2 years ago. And I just absolutely adore that thing because it's not a fast wireless charger, but it doesn't have a light on it. So I just throw the phone on there at night and I don't have any problems with lights in my room while I'm trying to sleep. I love it because I don't have to plug it in every single time. I don't have to fumble around in the dark for the cord. Just give me that, Google. Please.
All right, so...
They'd be happy to give it to you. Just spend money and buy the more expensive model in the fall. Yeah.
But the expensive one's going to be big, too.
All right, I want to end up talking a little bit about this proposed bill coming out of the Arizona State House. Jerry, this is interesting. It's not the first type of bill that we've seen like this. One in North Dakota recently was actually voted down. But this bill proposes that in the state of Arizona, Google and Apple specifically will be forced to accept credit card payments within apps that are directly to the processing company, so that they would be able to bypass Google and Apple as processors themselves. They would be forced to then let payment companies take the fees rather than Google and Apple take those 30% cuts and essentially allow Epic and other companies to bill consumers directly for in-app purchases.
This is Epic and Spotify versus Apple and Google. That's what
right.
this is.
Right, so why is that?
Because Epic and Spotify have both been very vocal, and when you come to Epic, I mean, look at the standoff that happened between them and Apple and Google over Fortnite. And they're losing so much money by, you know, giving Apple and Google a big chunk that they're just, they want that to stop. So they'll do anything to get it to stop because it is that much money.
But in theory, right, if an Epic or a, I mean, the whole Fortnite controversy started when Epic introduced direct billing and then gave everybody a quote 30% discount on V-Bucks as a result, which would be the amount that Epic would have to pay to Google and Apple. That's what got banned them from the store. That's where the lawsuit began, et cetera, et cetera. If companies were allowed to pay, were allowed to charge consumers directly and bypass Google and Apple, in theory, wouldn't those savings be passed along to consumers? Wouldn't I spend $9.99 on a Spotify subscription versus $12.99 if I have to buy it directly through the iPhone?
Absolutely, but is that fair to Apple? Apple is forced to host the app and host another mechanism for people that want to pay for it, like through their phone carrier or through, you know, an Apple card. Apple has to do all that, and they're not making any money because most people are just putting it on their, you know, MasterCard and saving $3. So I don't think this is the right solution. I'm glad to see this being an issue because it is totally not fair for Apple and Google to charge so much to, you know, the little guy. You know, maybe you've got a really good app, people really love it, and, you know, you just can't afford for Apple or Google to take, you know, what is it, 15% now for the first million or something. Anyway, that's money you could use to build your next great app or keep working on the app you have now. But you can't cut Apple and Google out completely.
No.
Because that's going to, I mean, what incentive does Google have to keep improving the Play Store if it's not making any money from it?
Right. I mean, the other argument here is that if this goes through and it has sort of ripple effects on the rest of the country, I mean, there's two options, right? Apple and Google, if this passes, could just choose to not offer the app or Play Store in Arizona anymore, which isn't going to happen.
Yep.
Or it could allow this law to go into effect in that state and just offer direct billing for certain developers in those states. But the other thing is that they could just, if a company starts offering direct billing, they could just remove them from the app or Play Store, right? Like this would,
right.
I don't know the specifics of this law if it comes to pass, and I'm sure there are stipulations in there that say they can't or would be discouraged from doing that. But the other part of it is that Google or Apple, if they didn't want to kick the app off entirely like they did with Fortnite, they could just stop promoting it, or they could do something else to suppress it so that they could highlight developers that do play ball and don't offer direct billing. I mean, these are still walled gardens, and they are still controlling the distribution of these apps.
See, and that's the problem. Both sides want it all. And you have to find a middle ground. And I know if you're on one side or the other, you think, oh, middle ground, that's nonsense. No, you have to find a middle ground so everybody makes enough money if you want things to continue to be friendly for consumers. I don't want to know that Google Play, if I do a search for Spotify, I'll find 15 little apps, manage Spotify playlists, blah, blah, blah. And at the very end, there'll be Spotify, the app, listed because Google doesn't want to promote it at all because they're losing money by having it in the store. I understand that. I don't want that to happen. But then again, I don't want, you know, Google to take 30% of Spotify's money. So I don't know what the middle ground is. But I really think that there's a lot of discussion about something that just can't happen. I don't see how you can do this on a state level. This has to be a federal law. What if I'm a developer from West Virginia? Do my customers in Arizona, can I offer them direct billing, but nobody else? The logistics of this are a nightmare. That's why we have federal laws for some things that just apply to everyone. And, you know, it's impossible to enforce. If this law would get passed tomorrow, nothing would really change except the worst case scenario. Apple first would yank Spotify out of the store, and then Google would probably follow suit. And that's not going to happen. So I don't see how this can be done at the state level, for starters. And that's what happened in North Dakota. I mean, love them, hate them, whatever. The legislators in North Dakota got it right that this is, you know, a federal issue, that it can't be done. The logistics of it are impossible. So I think the same thing's going to happen here.
Yeah, I mean, the North Dakota bill was a bit broader. It would have also forced Apple to allow third-party app stores, which is probably why the bill didn't pass. It was too broad, and it didn't really make sense for the sort of antitrust argument here.
Right.
But I mean, from what I understand, this is just a lobbying, like, battleground, right? Where the coalition against unfair app practices or whatever goes up against Apple and Google, and they just lobby. They spend millions of dollars on lobbyists to get certain state state lawmakers to say yes or no. They're going to do this across the country every single time a bill like this comes up. There are bills of some sort like this in Georgia, Hawaii, and Minnesota. This is gaining traction. I would not be surprised if this comes to New York and California at some point in some form. And when it hits those state legislatures, then we have to worry, because then we have the might. I don't think it'll happen, because those are Democratic-run legislatures, and Democrats don't seem to have as much ire against Apple and Google right now, not in terms of this particular issue. So anyway, it's very interesting. If this does end up passing, it will likely have a huge ripple effect and force Apple and Google to make some really hard decisions. But, you know, we're still waiting for it to go through the Senate, so we'll update you next week if it does that. In the meantime, the Verge has a really, really comprehensive rundown on everything about this bill, so I would go to read it there. All right, let's close out this week by going through what makes us happy. This is my favorite part of the week, because especially on a Friday, I just want everybody to feel happy and good when they leave this podcast. Harish, we'll start with you, because I know that you got to go and enjoy your evening, and I'm so sorry that I kept you this long. But what is making you happy this week?
I'm watching a cooking show, but it's not a regular cooking show. It's by James May. He's one of the old Top Gear crew.
He's from Top Gear, right?
Yeah, he made a cooking show, and it's wonderfully quirky and weird, and I love that.
Huh, I didn't know he had one.
Yeah, he does a lot of weird things. Last year, he made a documentary about Japan. He goes to Japan, and that one's really weird too, and it's really nice. Both of these are on Prime Video, so I've been having fun watching that show.
Awesome. So it's called O Cook. James May, O Cook. It's on Prime Video. Very cool. Ara, what's making you happy?
At the moment, the ease with which I can set up a Chromebook from scratch again, because my duet was having an issue with the screen where part of the rightmost section of the screen was being transposed onto the left. So I reset it during the podcast and set it up again.
Wow, that's real multitasking. Also, how dare you?
I'm sorry. It was just, this is irking me and I've got a couple of minutes and I can't really focus on anything else. I can log into all my accounts again. Sure.
Well, that's fair.
But yeah. I can't read anything while we're podcasting, because if I start reading stuff, then I will tune out whatever I'm listening to and read instead. So my options are either play a little match three games, that way I keep listening, but I keep the other part of my brain entertained, or reset up this duet so that way I could fix my feature. And joy of joys, resetting it fixed it. So yay.
All right. Well, that's very specific. Thank you. Jerry, what's making you happy this week?
Friend of mine got a CNC milling routing machine, and I've been finding little blocks of wood and making little CAD drawings. I've got a big box I'm ready to send to him since we can't visit each other right now, because I like to tinker in a little wood shop, and I mean, I don't build furniture or anything. I build things like chess sets, and I've always wanted one of those, and when you have a friend that has one, that's almost like having one of your own. So I plan on sending him a bunch of stuff, and then the weather will be warm, and I can go out there and lock the door behind me and turn the radio up really loud and glue things together.
That does sound like a lot of fun. I still want you to make me something. You promised to make me something out of wood once.
I have, and it's 90% finished. The part that I can't make is a little sprocket. But now I have a friend with a CNC milling machine, and he can make me a wooden sprocket, and your coffee grinder will be ready to go.
Oh my God, I'm so happy. This is the most exciting news I've heard all week. Very cool. Well, enjoy that. I hope the weather gets better soon, because it's still miserable here. But eventually spring will come and then we'll all go outside again. All right. So I'll go last because mine is also sort of nerdy. So I have three loves in my life. I have my wife, I have my daughter, and I have my 38-inch ultra-wide monitor. It is like, it's a Dell UW or U3818DW. It's basically Dell's formerly largest ultra wide curved monitor. And then they came out with a 49 inch. But I've had this for like 3.5 years now. I adore it. It's incredible. It is also massive, and the stand was massive. So I decided this week that I wanted to overhaul my office to make it a little bit more spacious and livable, and get rid of the stand on the desk. So I bought a very expensive monitor arm from a company called Ergotron, and it is incredible. I just, on a lark, found the lowest price, bought one. It's called the LX Desk Monitor Arm, and it is substantial enough to hold this 38-inch, 20-pound monitor, and it has freed up so much room on my desk. It looks better. It swivels any which way, so I can like push it up against the corner and just lean back and watch a movie if I want. I can have it right up close if I need to do some, you know, photo editing or something. It's super flexible, clears up room on my desk. It was $200 Canadian, which is about $140 US. So it's not cheap. But if you are looking for a really high quality monitor arm, I highly recommend this one, because I looked at all the ones on Amazon, including the Amazon Basics one that was well reviewed. But if you have a really heavy monitor, I wouldn't even go with that one. I would go a step up to something like this. So that is the Ergotron LX Desk Monitor.
That's the one with the gas shock and the big spring inside.
It comes in three colors. I could only get the aluminum one for that price, the black and white ones, which are a little bit more, they would have blended in better with my decor, but I couldn't find that one for like less than $300. So I decided not to.
Deal with the aluminum, because, you know, I have to get an Allen wrench and reach around behind my monitors and loosen a bolt if I want to pull them forward, and then tighten it once I get them there, because I've got two monitors on one arm, and it's just too much weight. So you've got the ticket want one.
I just love this monitor. Actually, Dell has a new one. They announced it at CES, I think. It's a 40-inch curved 4K, or it's a 5K 2K monitor. So it's 5K wide, 2K high, which is amazing. It's got better HDR support. It's a beautiful monitor. It's also $2,000, but it has a built-in Thunderbolt hub in there, which is insane. So I'm going to save up and buy this one because I'm obsessed now with the ultra-wide monitors. It's a problem. You develop hobbies in lockdown, and then you're like, oh my God, these are very expensive hobbies.
So I need to try an ultra-wide again because I had one for a while, and then I sent it back because I like to have a game open on one screen and on the other screen have Chrome open so I can see the cheats. LG has the thing where you can snap them, and it works pretty good, but it doesn't work with a lot of games. So I just like, nah, I can't do this. So I had to go back to using two.
Or you just, I solved that problem by having two different workstations in my office, one for working and one for gaming. But that's not practical for everybody.
Nah, especially since aren't they on opposite walls?
They are definitely on opposite walls. And it's a pain in the ass. But it's a fun pain in the ass because it means that I'm not staring at the same spot in my office all day. If I want a game, I just turn my chair around and there it is. So anyway. All right, that's it for the show. Harish, Ara, Jerry, thank you so much. This is super fun. You can find Harish at Chunky Nerd. You can find Ara at Ara Wagco. You can find Jerry at GB Hill. You can find me at Journey Dan. You can find all of us at Android Central. If you have any feedback for the show, let us know. podcast@androidcentral.com. If you listen to this on iTunes somehow, maybe on an I don't know, whatever. Leave us a comment. Leave us a review. We really appreciate it. If you listen to us on Spotify, what's wrong with you? But also, please email me and let me know because we are seeing an uptick in Spotify listens. And I want to know how you found the show or if you like migrated from Google Podcasts or Pocket Casts to Spotify. I don't know. If Spotify is promoting Android Central, I want to know about it. So send us an email. That's it for the show. We will be back next week with a really fun episode. Until then, have a great week and we'll talk to you later. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye.
Adios.